I can't have bored you yet. Let's get going. All right, so welcome everyone. Thank you for coming. Oh wait, I did a weird thing. Don't do that. There we go. Thank you for coming. You are, I think, in for a treat. This is, you may not have realized it, but this is the secret Microsoft-only internal session of the conference. How many people here are actually Microsoft employees? See? See? So this is the special session. We're going to talk about how we run SharePoint Online. I am Ben Canning. I am the head plumber of SharePoint Online. I make the trains run. I do the back of the house stuff that makes the magic happen. Actually, I don't do any of that. My team does that, and that's why they're sitting here in the room. So what I want to do today is really give you a very open perspective on our past year of growth and how we've managed to run the service at the scale that we run it at. And it really has been an amazing year. You saw these numbers at the keynote this morning. We've had 485% user growth since April. Jared said 500%. He's a marketing guy. I'm the geek. It's 485% is the number I know. And that's not trials. Those are not tire kickers who are sort of thinking about it. That's real paying customers actually going and using the site. And as you can imagine, that's generating a ton of usage. We gave you this 250,000 or more requests per second number. Compare that with 5,700 tweets per second, which is what Twitter reports for tweets per second. So we're kind of up there with the big boys. And we're seeing, you know, very large tenants come on online. This is one random tenant that I picked that's grown since December to 15,000 active users every day. And we're seeing other tenants be very spiky. So this is another tenant that didn't do anything for between December and February, and then woke up one morning and decided that they were going to send a mail, and 37,000 people showed up. And we have to be ready to deal with that, and we in fact are ready to deal with that. We've seen tremendous content growth. We're storing over 400 petabytes, 500% year-over-year storage growth in SharePoint alone. That's all sort of not pictures. It's not 400 terabytes of pictures of your cat. It's 400 terabytes of real user data, real collaborative documents that people are using to get work done. The other cool thing we're seeing is that while team sites are growing exponentially, OneDrive for Business has just taken off like a rocket, and we are seeing growth in that system that is staggering in its scale. And of course, that means we've got tons of machines. We're looking at, 400,000 some odd cores across O365, adding about 15,000 compute cores, compute and storage cores a month, 46,000 SQL databases in SharePoint Online, and we're adding thousands more of those a month. So all of that means a pretty impressive IT challenge to deal with that kind of growth and deliver it at scale and with reliability. And so that's what I want to talk to you about today. And I'm going to talk about four things. We'll talk about what we call our unbreakable mission, and that's all about delivering you the availability and the reliability that you expect. We'll talk about how we do change management and deliver you new capabilities and new features at a fast pace without disruption. We'll talk about our internal security efforts. And then I'm going to talk fairly deeply about Fort Knox, which you've been hearing about all day today, and how we're going to deliver this boundless encrypted storage that we've been talking about today. So let's kick it off. Simon, how many folks were at Simon's talk last hour? Okay, so we're gonna jump through a couple of things that Simon touched on, and we'll keep it new and fresh. So Simon showed you this O365 availability. So this is O365 service all up over the last six quarters. As you can see, Our SLA availability goal is 3.9s. We've exceeded that all of those past 6 quarters. But since this is the SharePoint conference and this is the secret internal Microsoft session, as we said, I'm going to open things up a little bit more. This is SharePoint Online availability specifically for every month of the last 12 months. And you're going to see a couple of really interesting things here. Number one, we've exceeded our SLA 11 of those last 12 months. And the trend line, as you can see, is quite positive in the right direction. And we are hitting up above 4.9s now since October. So that's awesome. You can clap for us for that. But the other thing that you will see is that in September, something terrible happened. And we didn't hit our availability goal in September. And so I want to talk to you for a minute about that. And I could try to gloss this over, but we're all IT professionals here. If I went out and told you that we were brilliant and perfect and nothing ever went wrong, you would laugh me out of the room. So let's talk about what actually happened here. So this is beautiful Sao Paulo, Brazil, where our Latin American data center is. Doesn't it look lovely? Around about the end of September, we had a cable severed in the Gulf of Mexico by a fishing trawler. It happens. The connection between Sao Paulo and our North American data centers was suddenly severed. So our monitoring caught this immediately, and we sprang into action to figure out what we wanted to do. And our initial investigation of the issue showed that it was an internal-only issue. That is, customers were still just fine. They were connecting to the service, uptime was good, availability was good. The only problem was connectivity back to our North American data center. So our monitoring wasn't working correctly, and that's why things looked bad. Or so we thought. So the first mistake is that the folks that were running this incident decided that this was an internal only issue, so we would wait and see how things played out. We'd try to get the cable rerouted and see if everything was going, see if we could fix it without any customer impact. So that's the first mistake, because then about 5 or 6 hours later, all of the customers who were accessing the site, well, it turns out they're accessing the site on cached authentication tokens. And those authentication tokens, due to a bug, have to be re-authenticated against North American data center, exactly, which they, of course, cannot get access to. So about 5 or 6 hours later, having happily done a bunch of work for the day, they start to lose access and availability drops through the floor. And now we have a serious problem. And we have a serious problem because since the data center's been active for 5 hours without connectivity back to the failover site, what's happened in that last 5 hours? We've built up 5 hours worth of data debt on the primary side that doesn't exist on the secondary side. So when you decide that you want to fail over to the secondary, you have this choice of, oh, do I throw away that 5 or 6 hours of customer data or what? And so this turns into a fairly lengthy outage. What we do is we fail over read-only to the secondary, so we bring accessibility back up for all of the content that we do have and allow users to get access to it. And we find a way to move the 5 hours worth of content that we don't have on the secondary basically overland through a circuitous route that avoids the cable cut and get it to the secondary and bring the secondary data center back up. So we didn't lose any customer data as a result, and we brought the site back up. And during the period of the outage, we were up read-only, but it was by far the worst single outage that we've ever had. Not our finest moment. So, we make mistakes and we learn from them. And there's sort of four key takeaways that we had from this. Number one is obviously we need to ensure independent and redundant connections between our data centers. We thought we had. Did my mic just go? Oh, there we go. We thought we had that in Latin America, but it turns out that the two redundant connections we had, they followed the same track on the undersea floor. Oops. So now we have two redundant connections into Latin America that follow very different paths. And in fact, we already had that in all of the other places in all of the other data centers in the world. Second key takeaway, nothing is ever internal only. The fact that we had lost monitoring connectivity and the fact that we had lost data transfer to the secondary is a huge deal. Nothing is internal only. So we've changed our processes and procedures to mandate that if something like this ever happens again, we initiate immediate failover and we treat it as a serious event that it was. The high availability for Active Directory authentication bug that we ran into, that was fixed. Ironically, the fix for that was in production. It just hadn't been turned on. We do this flighting thing where we sort of flight things into production and then we turn them on. It was there. It just hadn't been turned on. And the failover itself just took too long. And so we needed faster automated failover. And we've spent a significant amount of effort over the last year building much more automation into our failover systems to reduce the failover time. And one of the sort of side benefits of the Fort Knox effort that I'll talk about closer to the end is that we now have an easier way to do this last resort data migration if we have to from one data center to the other. So, not our finest hour, but trust is built through transparency. So I wanted to walk you through what happened and how we responded to it. And I want to talk to you about what we have seen is a growing maturity in our system. So I've shown you this 485% year-over-year active user growth, maybe 1,000 times so far. But the other interesting thing is, we operate on a DevOps model where my folks and all the folks in SharePoint actually carry the pagers. And ironically, it's actually my voice that you get. If you're woken up at 2 in the morning, it's me that with a recording that says, "This is Ben Canning with an important message from the SharePoint Online Data Center," and so everyone hates me, but it's okay. Because the person, if we have a front end go down, if we have a SQL database go down, the person who's gonna go fix that is the guy who wrote the code that does that. It's Steve Rayson, who has worked on the SharePoint Content DB for all of recorded history. That's the guy who's getting called to go and fix your database. But obviously, we like to reduce the number of those paging escalations. So what have we seen? This red line is the actual raw number of paging escalations that we have seen year over year. And so despite that 485% active growth, despite 500% storage growth, we've actually seen a 3x reduction in the number of paging escalations into our engineering. And so the thing that is cool here is that the level of maturity in our systems, our ability to self-heal, our ability to monitor and detect, our ability to avoid problems and fix the core issues, has actually more than kept pace with the user growth. So how did we do that? Well, if you look about a year ago, the sources of our escalations were basically broke down like this. You see a fair number of escalations in the SQL layer. You see a fair number of escalations in the CFEs. That's what we call our front end roles. You see a fairly big issue in our telemetry system itself, where the telemetry system wasn't rock solid, and so we would miss things because the telemetry system itself wasn't great. We fixed that issue. That has been completely eliminated. And then you see a vast amount of problems due to change. And I think anybody here who's an IT person isn't sort of surprised by that. Anytime you touch the system, you introduce entropy, and change is commonly a key one. So I'm going to talk through each of these as to how we made investments to improve these year over year. But this is what we see now. And so overall, we've had a 6x reduction in missed minutes. So the number of minutes of availability that we miss every month has been reduced by 6 times over the course of the last year. So I have to draw that new pie chart really small to compare to the original one. And what we see now is that the mix has shifted dramatically. Change is trivial. SQL is even more trivial. CFEs are still there as an issue, but it's mostly the issues there are now mostly load related because customers have started to really use the system and expand the breadth of their usage. And so the issues we see there are, number one, many fewer than we used to see, but number two, more related to increased usage. And then we see this long tail of sort of random issues that are one-offs, which is exactly kind of what we'd like to see. We've nailed the big guys, and we're down into the tail. So let me talk through a couple of these things and talk about what we did. So number one issue for us was getting the front ends healthy. And the real sort of key insight for us here was that load balancing and keeping healthy machines in rotation turns out to be really tricky. We run into issues. So like most of you, we have a ping system that'll ping the front end and say, hey, is this front end healthy? Well, that ping would load up a SharePoint page. Makes sense. We're testing SharePoint, see if it's healthy. Makes sense. Well, the page that it would load up would sometimes hit a database. So if the database is down, then the front end says, I can't render the page. And it tells the load balancer, I can't render the page. And the load balancer says, oh, that front end must be sick. So it takes the front end out of rotation. Well, so now you have a misdiagnosis issue because the front end is gone, but it's really SQL. And if the database that, and now you have an even worse problem because it turns out that all of the front ends that you have in that farm are trying to talk to that database, which is down. And so every single one of your front ends tells the load balancer, please take me out of rotation. And soon your whole farm is down because the load balancer has dutifully taken every single CFE out of rotation and taken the farm down. And that's not good. We also had an issue of sort of managing the F. We use, don't do that. We use F5s for our load balancing, and so you know managing those F5s was a manual process. You got to cut a ticket to the networking team and say, can you please go you know reboot the F5? Can you take this machine in and out of rotation? We didn't like doing that. So we've made a big investment in sort of fully automating all of that system with a system we call Circuit Breaker. Max sitting right there was the PM on it. And what Circuit Breaker does is a couple of things. Number one, it has sort of fully automated load balancer management. All of the logic for deciding whether or not a CFE is healthy or not has now been pulled out and into our front ends themselves. And they use sort of a pooled decision model. So first of all, we got a lot smarter about, hey, is this thing healthy by looking, okay, is the ping okay? What is the IS app pool okay? What do the perf counters on the box say? So we're looking not just is the machine dead or alive, but how healthy is the machine? And we can give a sort of differential analysis of how healthy a machine is. And then to provide ourselves with a safety net, the CFEs effectively talk to each other. And so they will ensure that that only a certain number of CFEs are pulled out of rotation at any given time, and the CFEs will dynamically put themselves back in, you know, pull themselves in and out of rotation to make sure that we have enough, healthy enough CFEs in rotation to continue to render service. Meanwhile, we're you know sending off alarm bells saying, please come and get more CFEs into rotation because we have an issue. So that allowed us to prevent that farm down situation that we had before. And that gave us a 17 times reduction in missed minutes for CFEs, and we were pretty happy with that. So then we moved on to SQL. And SQL, there's really three things that we focused on. Number one is that the monitoring has to be much better. How many people love the SQL mom pack and just apply it unchanged to their deployments? Nobody, because it goes berserk anytime you do anything. So we had to basically rewrite the mom pack for the SCOM pack for SQL so that it was aware of things like when it's okay for a mirror to be for a primary to not have a mirror and et cetera. We spent a bunch of time on host and mirror auto healing, so we can now automatically reach out and determine when a you know host is in a host is doesn't have a correct mirror set, and fix that problem up. We also do some work to sort of keep our bookkeeping in sync because, as you probably know, SQL knows who the primaries and the mirrors and the witnesses are, and SharePoint needs to know who the primaries are and who the mirrors are so that it can do the connection string magic, and our topology manager needs to know where the primaries and the secondaries are so that it can put them on the right racks. You never want to have the primary and the secondary on the same rack because then you've got a then you've broken your fault domain. All right, no bonus for you this year, Max. So all of those have to know about each other, and so keeping those three sets of books in sync is a challenge. And so we now have a system that goes through and basically queries SQL every minute or so and makes sure that everybody else is trued up with that. And then finally, we've done a bunch of work around the patching system so that we can patch SQL safely. So the patching system now knows which are primaries and which are mirrors. It knows about the mirror health of the system, and it can ask a SQL, hey, are you ready to be patched? And the SQL will tell it, yes, it's okay because my mirror is over here. Let me fail over to the mirror. Now you can patch my primary. And when you're looking at, you know, upwards of 60,000 SQL databases, you really need that to be completely automatic and just flush through the system. And that work got us 100% reduction in missed minutes over the last 6 months. And so we were really happy about that. We've also had this problem of managing SQL growth. So we have this issue with, you know, the level of the speed of growth that we're seeing, that we're constantly having to rebalance SQL databases across the system to maintain a decent balance and not overwhelm individual machines. That we can do. We can do seamless moves of databases without any downtime. But when databases get too big in themselves, and we need to split the database out, that we have to take read-only time for. And I don't know if folks have seen this evil dialogue or this evil toolbar thing in the service. Anybody seen this thing? Yeah, okay, a couple of people. Well, you don't count. But a couple of people. This thing is evil, right? So this thing, we try to do this on off business hours, but basically, you know, every couple of months I'll get a flame mail from, you know, a customer in New Zealand who's like, oh, this thing came up and I'm trying to do work and what are you doing? So we want to get rid of this thing. And I'm happy to announce that we are getting rid of it. And we're introducing this new concept we call DB mitosis that allows us to split a database up with zero downtime. And this is something that we'd actually hope to bring on premises with our next release. And DB mitosis, I mean, it's pretty straightforward in concept. Basically, we take this database, we use backup and restore to copy all of the content in. We use log shipping to get them up to date. And now we're going to lock the database for just a few seconds while we let the logs catch up. This only takes a few seconds. Catch up the logs. We'll update the sitemap on both sides. So now the database on the left, he's going to keep half of the site collections, and the database on the right is going to keep the other half. And we update the sitemap to tell which site collections are going to be retained in each of those databases. Flag the other half for deletion. And now we can unlock the databases and restore read-write traffic. That all happens in a couple of seconds. The cleanup operation happens in the background, and what we're left with is two databases that are half as big as they were before, and we can do this ad infinitum to expand out the system with no downtime. That system is rolling out into production now, and so you should start seeing that, or you should no longer see the read-only time. So I think at this point we will be at sort of truly zero read-only time for any kind of standard maintenance operations that we do, which is great. The other major SQL-related availability problem that we have is around disaster recovery. And we talked about the issue in Latin America that we had. One of the big problems that we have is that our failover granularity is not as granular as we would like. So currently we're failing over an entire farm at a time, and that has a bunch of downsides. So we're embarking on a project that is fairly baked at this point and rolling out in a couple of places. To tackle the proliferation of databases in SharePoint. You know, as you know, if you run SharePoint, we've got a lot of databases in SharePoint. The Content DB, the Site Subscriptions DB, the App DBs, the UPA taxonomy, et cetera, et cetera. And having this many databases is kind of a big pain because you gotta go talk to the SQL guy and say, hey, can I have another database? And you've got a different configuration and different retention policies for each one of them, and you've got to manage all of them differently. And it's a big pain. And from an availability perspective, it's not so great either, because while the Content DB, if it dies, it just impacts the couple of tenants that are in that Content DB. If any of these guys die, they impact the entire farm because all of the tenants in the farm are inside of those DBs. So wouldn't it be great if you could collapse all of those federated DBs into the Content DB itself? And that's in fact what we've done. And I've got this running in dog food in the service now. We'll roll it out over the rest of the year. And my hope, Max's head depends on this, is that I can ship this in our next on-premise release. So that will mean you'll just have content DBs to deal with in the future. And the huge benefit of this is that now all of our data is tenant partitioned. So we have, you know, just one config and maintenance and monitoring system to do. And we can now take that that single collapse DB, and when we have a farm of those, rather than having to fail over an entire farm at a time, when an individual database dies, I can just bring it up on the secondary side and restore access to that DB instantaneously. So that gives us a tremendous amount of flexibility to handle single database failures very quickly. But it also means that in the case of a true disaster where I've lost the entire data center, I can fail over all of the DBs and not have to wait for all of the DBs to fail over in order to restore service. So in other words, if I have 1,000 databases that I need to move, if I have to wait for all 1,000 to move and come back up to life before I can give anybody access, that's going to take a long time. There's always going to be that one database that is horked in some way and it doesn't want to move and we got to do something special. So now I've got a system where as databases get over there, I can just bring them back online. And so my failover times will be much, much faster. And then obviously this implies that that we can start to move to more of an active-active model. And by here, active-active, I don't mean some multi-master thing where we're reading and writing on both sides, but I do mean that both data centers and both farms are actively serving content from some DBs at one time or another. That gives me confidence that my failover side is happy and healthy and serving traffic, gives me better hardware utilization. So this all I think we'll be able to bring you on-prem. No promises, but this is where us running the service starts to bring you some real value. The other big thing, I told you this was going to be super geeky presentation, but I like this stuff, so you know, there you go. So the other big thing that we're doing is a bunch of work around topology simplification that we call MinRoll. So right now, when we deploy the service, we've got all of these roles. You know, we've got content front ends, and we've got crawl targets, and we've got application servers, and we've got, oh God, timer job machines, and et cetera. We've got the federated farm with all of its stuff in it, and all of the search stuff, and so forth. And in theory, this makes it look kind of cool, because you've got role separation, and maybe you can scale out each role individually, and you can isolate problems to a specific role, but it's all nonsense, because what really happens is that you've got this huge fragility. Every transaction that comes into the system has got to go talk to like five different machines. And so you've got intra-farm traffic latency issues to worry about, and if that one machine is down, then you've got the whole request chain is going to blow up. It makes it hard to do your capacity management because you really need more front ends, but you don't have space for them, but you've got, you know, seven cap roles over here that aren't really being used, and you wish you could transfer one to the other. So you'd really like to fix this, and so the thing that we've got rolled out in MSIT, and as soon as the conference is over, we can start rolling it out to the rest of the world, is a much simpler topology where you say, look, what you really want is you want a set of roles that are focused on handling user traffic and a set of roles that are focused on handling what we call bot traffic, so the search crawler or the timer jobs or things that are not, you know, things that real users are doing. And then you've got the sort of shared shared velocity roles. And you'd really like to sort of unify those all down into a much simpler topology where every service is running on every machine, and the machines are selectively handling user or bot traffic as necessary. And that gets you a much simpler topology where all user traffic is hitting, you know, one or more, you know, is hitting one of these user roles. And I can use the web request router or, you know, any load balancer you want to make sure that I'm routing user traffic into those user roles, and I can scale them out independently. And bot traffic is never hindering the user traffic. So that gives me a much simpler topology, much easier capacity management, less fragility, and better performance for users. Now, What about on-prem? Well, if you look at this, you'll see that it's actually pretty close to the product line architecture guidance that we've already got published, and I've put a link to that PLA guidance in the deck here. We highly recommend that you follow that guidance as you think about topologies that you're deploying on-prem. And we're also going to be deploying these two new flags that allow you to run in this kind of a configuration on-premises. We think those will be coming in a cumulative update pretty soon now. Phil is the guy that knows all about that. But prefer self is basically allows the role to say, hey, if I'm able to handle this request, just route it back to me. It tells the SharePoint farm load balancer to route the request back to itself. And so that way you can keep the traffic just on the box itself. So we think this is a huge win for on-premise topology building as well, and a huge win for the service. All right. Let's talk about change. I showed you that change was our biggest source of missed minutes. Four real things that drove that. Number one, too many humans in the mix, too much manual process in the mix. So you want to drive automation into the system. We weren't very graceful in our change management, and by that I mean the systems that drove change into the system weren't very knowledgeable about the rest of the system, and so they would just sort of blunder through, applying patches to SQL roles without understanding the impact they were having on the SQL system, or really being able to tell SQL, hey, I need to apply a change to you, let's make that work. And they were disconnected from our telemetry system, so the changes would roll through, they'd knock a SQL server offline, the telemetry system would wake up and say, ah, there's a SQL server offline, somebody should go do something, but the change system was completely unaware of that, it just rolled right on through. And then the other thing that's a little nuanced, we were making change too slow. And this is a little bit of a nuanced point, but there's a lot of developers working on SharePoint doing cool things to bring new value to y'all. And so if you wait 3 months to make your changes, you've got 3 months of a few hundred developers going and doing cool stuff. Well, that's like now a mountain of changes that you've got to reason about and figure out, okay, did we break something and how does it all fit together? And so you look at that mountain. And Jackie, who runs testing, will say, hey, we better test the snot out of that because we don't want to break anything. So let's go test it for 3 months to make sure that it's okay. Well, the developers didn't go on vacation for 3 months. Now you've got 6 months of stuff that they've done. And you say, oh, well, we should test that a little bit more. And then it goes on and on. And you've seen when we release on-premises, right, we spend 3 years of developing stuff. And then we hand it to you and say, here you go, good luck. And it takes you a year and a half to deploy it because it's a mountain of change. So what we found is that actually if we go fast and the increments of change are much smaller, that we get better results, we get more reliable results, less impact. And in particular, particularly important for that is this notion of having a tripwire. And Simon talked about this in some great detail in his last talk, so I won't go into it. But the basic idea here is that we have multiple phases of deployment, multiple rings that every change has to go through. And at any point, a developer can reach up and pull the cord and say, we got to stop. Something is wrong. And then the thing I really want to talk about is this notion of seamless change and 100% automation. And seamless change was really this massive engineering effort that we did to make it possible for us to do upgrades fast and without a lot of impact. Let me talk about that. So folks have done SharePoint version-to-version upgrades. It's pretty expensive and painful. It's a big deal. It was expensive and painful for us too, and we have to do it a lot. So what we've done is invested in something we call compute-only upgrades, and this is how it works. So you can see this is our farm on the left and our SQL roles down below. So what we do is we deploy a new target farm, and that new target farm is built off of our VM build system. It's got all the latest security patches, all the latest SharePoint goodies on it. So we deploy that new farm and we dual mount the databases. So now both farms are talking to the same databases. At the same time, we've split out the sitemap. So we can bring the sitemap over and not have to take the time to do a sitemap rebuild. That's another thing we think will come on-prem next time. Now we start sending synthetic traffic over to that new farm to make sure that the new farm is up and happy and healthy. And when we see that it is, we start to route real tenant traffic over to the new farm. And as we see that that is happy and healthy, we will move and tear down the old farm. And all of that is completely automated and takes about 12 hours per farm. And we can do it in parallel. And so as a result of that only taking 12 hours, we've been able to radically improve our deployment times. So, before you take the picture, let me show you the good numbers. So it used to be that it would take us about 2 weeks to roll patches out into the system. And now every 24 hours, I can patch the entire system with any critical security patches, with any bug fix level changes that we have. And every 2 weeks, I am rolling an entirely new, effectively an entirely new version of SharePoint out into production through the rings. So the entirety of SharePoint is completely security patched and brings you new features every 2 weeks as a result of that work. And we do it through the rings with no disruption and no downtime during any of those operations, which we think is pretty cool. So automation is key. And so in addition to that that major effort around version-to-version upgrade, we've also focused on automating all of our maintenance tasks. We have a system called Merlin that is really cool. So a developer, rather than going and cutting a ticket with some operations guy who goes into the data center and twiddles the machine, we have a thing called the Grid Manager. A developer can write some automation pretty quickly, check that automation in, it gets deployed into production, and he can then invoke that as effectively like an API call into the Grid Manager, and the Grid Manager will go and execute that operation. So anything that we need, like, hey, I need a way to go and reboot a SQL server. I need a way to go and twiddle this setting on a front-end box. I need to go and retrieve this sanitized piece of information so that I can do troubleshooting. All of that can be done through Merlin without the developer ever having to go and touch a box and without him ever having to go and talk to someone in operations to do it manually. And that, we've reduced our manual touches on the system by 2.5 times over since May. And we just see that system getting used more and more every day. And the really critical thing for me about Merlin, let me shift gears and talk about security now. The really critical thing about Merlin is that it allows us to run the system with no standing access to the data centers. So using this technology we have called Lockbox, no developer, no operations person has standing access to your data in the data center. So we don't want humans touching your data. I don't want them to have access to it. The fewer people that I can, that get in there, the better from my perspective. And Lockbox allows us to do that. We use automation using Merlin to do the majority of repairs. In the cases where we actually do need content access to go and remediate some problem, the Lockbox system allows us to do just-in-time access into the database. So you go to the Lockbox tool, you say, I need access to this thing. Lockbox will check, do you still work on our team? Are you still authorized? Is your background check up to date? What thing are you trying to do? What thing are you trying to get access to? And it will grant you access to just the thing that you need access to for just the amount of time that you need access to. That you need access to it, and then it will automatically revoke that access when you're done. And of course, because all access is handled through that single system, all of it is logged into our Cosmos system. So I know definitively every access onto a box, who it was done by, what was done, how long was it done, etc. And that logging, we log over 10 terabytes of data a day into the Cosmos system, not just people who have accessed, but process starts and telemetry data and et cetera. All of that data completely sanitized, so no customer data is ever leaving the data center, but 10 terabytes a day of security and other data going into that data system. And then we have this red team that basically lives to look at that data and manage it. And we use sophisticated machine learning algorithms to understand patterns. We saw Simon did a really cool demo with Matt Swan the last hour. So I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but you know, those guys are doing some really clever stuff, going in and just identifying weird patterns. They have these great visualization tools so they can see that, like, hey, this process logged into that machine and we've never seen that happen before. Is that an okay thing? Let us go proactively analyze what's going on there and make sure that's copacetic. You know, I mean, you want all the physical security that you can have and all of the data encryption that you have, but you also want the night watchman, you know, walking around looking for stuff that looks funny. And that's what these guys are doing on top of it. We're also use this crowdsourcing thing. This thing is cool. So we will, certain activities inside the data center, the system will automatically notice that, oh, you know, user so-and-so granted access to this thing to, you know, user B. And we'll generate an email automatically that says, hey, did you really do that? And we've actually tested this system. We've generated, you know, fake alerts saying, you know, hey, Steve, you granted access to Bob, yesterday. Was that really you? And we find that Steve will say, no, that wasn't me. And then we, you know, so it actually works. It actually works pretty well. And so all of this is handled by our red team. And the red team is really critical. And I, you know, to the extent that you can do this on, in your own environments, I just can't recommend it enough. So the red team is the team that keeps us on our toes. They are using all of those tools to do proactive security analysis, but they're also they also test us with regular penetration test attempts to see if they can break in. And to keep us on our toes. I asked them to send me an anecdote about what was their latest findings on the system. They sent it in. It's a little bit redacted. They're a little bit tricky, but it says the service is fine, so I think that's good. I actually do have an anecdote that I probably won't get in too much trouble sharing. So a couple months ago, I get the scariest email that I've ever gotten, and it's from like the Microsoft cybersecurity defense team, and it says, we've just been contacted by the FBI. They've shut down a major botnet, and they have found that there's some Office 365 customer content on the machines that this botnet has, and so you should do something. And of course, all blood drains from my face, and I go, oh my, this is a disaster, and so we spin up our security response system because we have, you know, a detailed plan of exactly what we're going to do, and we spin up our security response system, and they dive into the data center, and they try to figure out, okay, where could the exfiltration have happened, and do we see any, you know, and they sort of figure it out. Well, it turns out that, of course, this is a drill, and it's a drill not by my red team, which is the SharePoint red team, but by the Office 365 red team, because their red team wanted to test our red team to see if our red team was really on their toes. So we've got like layers of red teams trying to test, you know, and these guys are competitive and they want to trick the other guy. And so, but man, so having that level of, pressure and keeping you on your toes, we find incredibly, incredibly valuable. All right, so then lastly, let's talk about, this is actually going faster than I thought. So lastly, let's talk about data protection. So obviously, we take data protection, data encryption incredibly seriously. So we are offering, you know, best in breed encryption in transit using, you know, the best SSL. We have best in class cryptography, perfect forward secrecy, and 2048-bit key links will be coming by the end of this year. We encrypt almost all traffic between all of our data centers, and we will have all traffic between our data centers encrypted by the end of this year. That has become increasingly important in the wake of some of the recent revelations about things. So all the traffic between our data centers goes over our own private links, but we're going to be encrypting all of that traffic even so. And of course, we're going to provide encryption at rest. And we have this rolled out in some of our dedicated environments right now. It will be live in production, rolling out starting, I believe, next month, and rolling out throughout production in the subsequent months. So we will provide AES 256-bit encryption at rest on all of your data. So up and down the stack, from in transit, intra-data center, at rest, we are going to be encrypting your data with the highest level of encryption, because we truly value the, you know, we consider this incredibly important that we keep your data safe. But that's not enough, and we wanted to do more. And so now I want to talk to you about the more that we want to do. So you want infinite storage that expands to meet your needs. We've seen, you know, this incredible explosion in data usage. But you also want to know that your data is securely protected. And so we started working on something that we call Fort Knox. And Fort Knox is something that we think provides this level of unlimited storage and unparalleled security that is something that is sort of brand new to the industry. Nobody else is doing anything close to this. So let me talk about the unlimited storage side of things. So we've seen this growth, and if we look at that growth, we'll see that the vast majority of the data that we see in our databases is documents. It's the content that people are sending to us. At least 80% of the actual data is the documents themselves, and then you've got a little bit of metadata over here. Now, because we have available to us the power of the Windows Azure Boundless Cloud Storage System, we can take those documents and put them in Azure and grow the document store effectively infinitely. And we're now left with a little tiny bit of metadata in our store, which means that our databases can be small. And yes, this means that we like remote blob storage for SharePoint data. Although the RBS provider that we have right now has got some challenges with it, we like this system a lot. So that's going to give us easily terabyte site collections and OneDrives and infinite overall storage. And if you've seen some of the tweets today about OneDrive for Business and the pricing we're putting around that offering, I think it's an incredibly compelling offering relative to the competition. All right, so but I promised you that we were doing more about security. So let's talk about that. And now you got to wake up for a minute, because we're going to get geeky and crypto-y for a minute here, but it's really cool. So you know that we use a shredded store. We introduced that last version. And the shredded store is great because it means that rather than storing individual full files in the database, we take those files and we shred them into tiny little shreds. That means that instead of sending 70 megabyte PowerPoint presentations back and forth over the wire, you're just sending the diffs back and forth. It also means, from a storage perspective, we're storing only the diffs when we store versioning. So the overhead of having versioning turned on is much better. It means we get better co-authoring performance. So there's a lot of benefits to the shredded store. So we've taken that shredded store concept, and we're going to build encryption on top of it. So what I'm going to do in Fort Knox is I'm going to generate four unique keys. In this case, I'll use four because it's simple to sort of reason over. In reality, we're talking about, 40 shreds, 100 shreds, something like that. For each of those shreds, I'm going to generate a unique cryptographic key, and I'm going to encrypt each of those shreds with that unique key. So a different key for every shred. So now I'm going to open up the vaults inside of SQL Azure. So you can think of SQL Azure as being hundreds of thousands of individual bank vaults where I can put things. And in order to unlock the vault, I'm going to need a vault key. And so, I almost used the old internal code name that I'm not supposed to use. So in order to use that in Fort Knox, we have a key store. And the key store is great because the key store holds the cryptographic keys, and it's one place where those keys live, so I can watch it like a hawk And that's the, you know, that's sort of the one place that if you wanted to get the keys, you'd have to come here. And so that thing is very nicely contained. So I'm going to go get those individual keys. And notice here that every vault has its own key. So unique keys for every shred and unique keys for every vault. Now we'll take those key, those shreds, and we'll put them in the vault, lock the vaults up. Now I've got the keys for the shreds. I'm going to take those keys, I'm going to generate a whole new key, and I'm going to encrypt those guys. So now you've got the keys that are the thing you need to get at the shreds, and those have been further encrypted, and then we're going to put those in the content DB, because the content DB effectively has the map from the keys to the content. Put that key away. Now, what have I got here? We're going to keep all of this safe. No attacker's ever going to get anywhere near any of this stuff. But for the sake of argument, let's say that an attacker did. So one thing that the attacker might do is he might try to find a way to get at the content DB and grab the content DB. Well, that's not going to do him very much good. The content isn't in the content DB. It's in the vaults. And the keys that are in the content DB, well, they're encrypted with a key that he doesn't have. So the content DB isn't a very useful thing for him to get. He might try to go after the vaults themselves, but he can't get into the vaults because he doesn't have the keys to get into the vaults. And even if he could, all that's in the vault are hundreds of millions of shreds that have been encrypted with 100 million different keys that he also doesn't have, because those are all encrypted inside the content DB. So even taking the vaults, he can't get anything really. And he might finally try to go after the key store because, oh, that's got all the keys in it. But if he gets just the key store, now he's effectively got, he doesn't have the map. So he's effectively got a key ring with a billion keys on it. And he's looking at a billion safety deposit boxes. And he doesn't know which key goes to which box. So the key store itself is no good. He'd have to somehow manage to compromise the entire system, get all three pieces of data, put it all together. It's unparalleled levels of security. Even if he could get the keys to the vaults, every day we burn all the keys to the vaults and we generate new keys and new locks for the vaults. So every day it's all new keys. So we think putting all of this together, we're going to give you both unlimited storage and unparalleled security that nobody in the industry can touch, because that's how serious we are about keeping your data safe and earning the trust that you've put in us. So that's basically what I have. You know, summing up, we talked about, you know, the reliability wins that we've had and meeting SLA for all of these months and getting up to 4.9s and the increasing maturity that we're seeing in our system. We talked about how we can deliver cool new functionality to you, you know, every day and every 2 weeks with no disruption to your business. We talked about how we're going to deliver fundamental security and keep and limit access to your data. And we talked about Fort Knox with its unlimited storage and unparalleled security. So with that, I'll say thank you, and I'll take any questions. So Lockbox is a internally developed technology that it's actually based on FIM, which we use for identity management. And so whether or not we would offer that as a product is an interesting question. We use that as a sort of cross 365, you know, unified service, because we want to sort of manage access and identity uniformly across 365. So, you know, I don't know of any plans to bring Lockbox itself on-prem, but it's worth thinking about. Yeah. So Fort Knox is sort of fundamentally a cloud service today. It's it leverages Windows Azure Storage to store the blobs and to do much of the key management. A lot of the key management is managed by our grid manager system. I would love to be able to offer it on premises. We'll take a look at it. My gut says it's unlikely to move on-prem. There. Mm-hmm. As far as I understand, the PLA scripts are. I shouldn't stand in front of that. The PLA architecture diagrams are, you know, and sort of guidance are public. I don't know if we have scripts that will sort of auto-configure. One of the interesting things, though, that we are thinking about for the on-prem release, it's actually kind of worth getting some feedback on this. What if in the next on-prem release, what we did was we used the thing we call the grid manager, which sort of manages the creation of stamps. What if we gave you VMs and had the grid, you know, and sort of shipped the grid manager, and what we deployed out of the box was, you know, essentially this MinRoll config in a bunch of VMs, and then you could go after the fact and use Topology Manager or any of those tools to tweak the topology, but we, you know, there was no setup and post setup config step. There was just please give me another farm, and we would go there you go. That's something we're thinking about, that would build on that MinRoll topology and some of the script work that we've done to do, you know, much faster topology management. I think you had your. We haven't made any changes to the RBS provider, and in fact, Alcatraz doesn't. Sorry, Fort Knox. Damn it! Alcatraz is the place where you put bad people. Fort Knox is the place where you put your treasure. So you would never want to call something Alcatraz because that would be bad. You would want to call it Fort Knox because that would be good. This is why I'm not in marketing, Fort Knox does not actually use the RBS provider. We use a custom thing that we wrote to talk to Windows Azure. Yeah, I think we'll have to look at how much of the sort of MinDB and RBS provider, you know, work that we've done we can bring to on-prem. A lot of it depends. There's some of it that should just flow. A lot of it depends on some cloud things. And then once you bring it on-prem, actually the trick with MinDB coming on-prem is actually about migration, because you know, everything is spread apart now, and so if you want to move to MinDB, now you have to write a bunch of scripts for on-prem to sort of collapse everything together. And we don't quite have the same problem in the service. So we'll have to see. Yeah, that's a great question, Phil. He wants to know about how we can make things faster. Phil has a great talk on Thursday morning about Phil runs our perf team, he has a great talk coming on Thursday morning about, you know, sort of how to optimize your pages in SharePoint and SharePoint Online to deliver deliver better performance. But I will give sort of the short answer. So there's kind of, I guess there's three main things I would say. Number one, as we have, number one is sort of getting server side performance in good shape. As we have grown by, you know, such leaps and bounds, we've had to run pretty fast to just sort of keep up with how many CFEs how many front ends do we need to maintain the level of performance that we want on the server side. So we put a lot of effort into scaling those out, building building capabilities to ramp up CFE scale as needed. And so I feel reasonably good about that. The second thing that we're working on is sort of more robust throttling built into the system. What we find is that there are a lot of cases where folks will do either some kind of funky customization. I shouldn't say funky. Like, you'll do some customization that seems like it should be fine, but it has an abnormally large impact on the farm. You'll build an app that just hammers the farm. SharePoint's been very successful because we've built a ton of customization capabilities into the product. But now that you run it as a multi-tenant service, everybody needs to kind of have their own sandbox. And I would say we need to invest more in providing those sort of automatic guardrails for the system. And one of the things we're working with Rob Howard and the apps team on is how do we provide a better set of APIs for developers to use so that we can provide guidance about, like, hey, here's how much bandwidth you're actually consuming, and here's how much we're going to throttle you down, and here's how to da, da, da. So that's thing number two. Thing number three is we're making a bunch of investments at the network level. We've talked, Simon talked last hour about, we ran the Sochi Olympics basically off of the Microsoft network backbone, 3.1 million active streamers for the last hockey game, one of the largest live events ever in the history of the planet. So our network infrastructure is really strong. So we have an effort we call the Office Edge, which is all about sort of partnering with Bing to push our network out to the edge of the internet and partner with all of the ISPs all over the world so that traffic is routed directly into our network much faster. And that thing will come out, I think, later this year. But we've seen in our early testing that produces some tremendous performance improvements. The quicker you can sort of get into our network, do SSL termination at the edge, and then route into our network, the much better you'll be. But you're seeing, we should. I mean, we should certainly talk about that. The edge investments are joint across us and Exchange. The performance issues, I think, with SharePoint Online are. Of a different order than Exchange. The Exchange team, the user model is much more of a sort of store and forward model. You boot up Outlook, you go and send and receive your mail. That sort of instant, there's a lot of sort of offline caching. With SharePoint, it's much more about, I'm going to go to the web page, I expect the web page to be there and render immediately. And so I think the performance issues that we have, when we do have performance issues, those tend to get exacerbated. Exchange also has sort of a nice partitioning model where, that you have your inbox and he has his and she has hers and so forth, whereas we have lots of people going to, the sort of one site. It's not to make excuses, just, different, we have somewhat different user models. I would say this last year has been a lot for us about availability and, ensuring that we could deliver core availability. The mission that my team is on right now is really a lot around base performance. And we're going to have to tackle that at the network layer, at the server backend, and in the page model itself. If you use some of the new mobile pages that the team has built, you'll see that we can render a OneDrive page, on a tablet like that. And, it is super fast and hella responsive. We need to take that model and, backtrack it into the default experience. And that's something that we're very actively working on right now.
Come talk to me, I'll tell you why yours is so good.
Yeah, actually, he's got some cool tools. He can, you know, if we can take a tenant and we can see exactly what their performance has looked like over the last few days, how does it compare with others in region, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Oh, I see. So the question was about, does Fortnox have a hard dependency to SharePoint Online? No, in fact, it depends. I mean, I think the short answer is no. And in fact, what you'll see is, you know, Exchange start to use our store for, you know, for example, attachment storage. So that, you know, when you go to attach a file in an email in Exchange Online, rather than that email getting embedded in the mail itself, that email gets, you know, placed inside of a OneDrive with appropriate permissions so that we're not, you know, sending those things around. So a bunch of benefits to that. So I think you'll start to see those two systems merge. As to whether or not Exchange will use this sort of Fortnox style shredded store, that's something that we're talking with them about. They have their own sort of highly optimized storage model. And it's not shredded in the way that ours is, so it might be more challenging to have them do it, but it's certainly something that we'll look at. Sorry, what's that? Well, I would say by default, any data that an app stores inside of SharePoint gets stored inside the ContentDB, and so it will therefore be stored inside of Fortnox. Well, so Fortnox really exists at the lower storage layer. It will be transparent to you as an app developer or a user of the service whether or not the storage is in Fortnox or not. There's no sort of special thing that, you know, where you put it into Fortnox. So the quota limits that we talked about, those go live today. The underlying storage platform getting rolled to Fortnox, that will happen over the course of the next several months as we sort of slowly roll it out to the system. That'll all be sort of transparent under the covers to you. Let me just do a time check. All right. Oh wait, let me get him because you already got one. We have had cases like that. Typically, the issues are localized to the site collection. I would say we have two classes of issues. One where the customer does something to the site collection that they need to recover from. You know, they wiped out all the permissions, or they, you know, deleted a bunch of stuff that they didn't want, that they later didn't want to delete, and we do offer some recovery options in those cases. And we've seen a couple of cases with bugs where we had a bug in InfoPath where it was possible to craft an InfoPath form that would kind of go into an infinite loop, and as soon as you uploaded the form, it started to take the farm down. What we do today in those cases is we have some throttling tools that we can use on a per user and a per tenancy basis to say, you know, something you're doing is impacting the rest of the farm, and so we're gonna stop it and make sure that everybody else on the farm is healthy, and then reach out to you and figure out what's going on. Over time, you know, what we'll want to build in more and more safeguards around that. Because right now I have kind of a heavy hammer where I can say, I don't know what you're doing, but I'm stopping it, and then we'll go and talk about what it is. And that makes everybody else on the farm happy, but not, you know, that particular tenant. And so we're trying to get much more sophisticated about automatically throttling, you know, resource usage and so forth. Yeah. We've definitely had those cases where we have had to reach out to a customer and talk to them about, oh, okay, let's figure out a way to do this. Anybody else? Oh, yeah. That's right. Any Crackle guys here? Oh, yeah, you want to talk to that, Zohar? Yeah. Yeah, so for example, we don't do any, you know, DB schema upgrades during that process.
But there's also one difference, right? So you don't make a copy of the database. On premise today, when you do an upgrade, you make a value farm, you make a backup of the database, you restore them. If something goes wrong, you can always just go back to the old copy, right? In the multi-tenant service, we don't have any customization, so it's well tested. We go through the ring, and by the time we get production, it's safe for us to do that and like not make a copy, because we're very confident. One premise my gut would still be to go with the way that we do it today. You don't need to do these massive performance like at a time. You have like a couple of pumps. You have thousands, like hundreds of pumps. So if I was an upgrade guy today, I'd still do it the old way.
Yeah, in the back. Ah, this is an excellent question. So the question was, does Fort Knox protect against governmental subpoenas of your data? So let me say this. We do not just hand data over in a subpoena situation. So we work hard and we fight. There is nothing inherent in Fort Knox, as I described it today, that prevents a government agency with a, you know, duly served subpoena that they've, you know, fought through in court from, you know, going in and getting the data. One thing that we often hear customers ask about is, can I provide my own key? And one thing that you may notice, one thing that you may notice in the Fort Knox design is this key is the key that was used to encrypt the shred keys. Without this key, it is impossible to recover any of the shreds. And so in theory, a customer could provide this key and then revoke that key from our access, and we would have no way of accessing the ContentDB data or the shreds ever again. Not prepared at this time to say any more than that that is a feature of the design, but that is a feature of the design. And it is conceivable that since this key is provided at a farm, you know, every farm has its own sort of master key, that a customer that was in a dedicated farm could have that capability. Wink. Now I just got in trouble, but so that's one thing. I think the other thing that's kind of interesting. If you look at the data centers that we opened in China this year, those data centers are really interesting because they're operated by our partner 21V. We have no access to the data in those data centers. We have no administrative access whatsoever. If I want to get at the content in those data centers, I have to ask 21V to authorize my access into the data center. And that was very important to the customers in the Chinese market, that there be no way for, so even if someone asks me to go and get the data, I can't get it unless 21V, which is a Chinese company, grants me that access. And we are the only company that has the capability and has, in fact, delivered on that kind of a setup. And you could imagine that we might do that again. But again, I'm not announcing anything, but we've done it, and we're the only ones that kind of, by the nature of the way our fabric works and the fact that we grew up from the enterprise, we're the only ones who, I think, you know, can do it. Question? Oh, sorry. Guys, it's 5:01, and I will stay as long as you want, but Club SBC is starting, so if you want to go, you know, dance and drink, you are more than welcome to do that, but thank you. So the question was about, does this satisfy safe harbor? I am not a lawyer, but my understanding is that yes, because the Azure data centers are similarly regionally located with our data centers. So you know, if you're an EMEA-based company, you're going to have data inside of the EMEA region, you know, the European region Azure data centers, just as your corporate data is inside of the EMEA region data centers as well. So I don't think, to the extent that we satisfied Safe Harbor before, I think we will continue to satisfy Safe Harbor with this solution. Is that? I don't know if Jeff isn't here, but let me give you my card and follow up with me. The guy who can answer that question is on speed dial for me. Got a question over here, yeah.
Yeah, how much did we hear today apply to dedicated?
Oh, great question. So the way to think about, there's sort of a now and a then question. So a lot of what you heard today applies to dedicated now, particularly like the encryption at rest stuff, where actually we're rolling that to dedicated first. The plan for dedicated, keep me honest, the plan for dedicated is that today dedicated exists on sort of a separate fabric. We want to unify the fabric together. Zohar there is the guy who is driving that project. So we want to unify the fabric together. Once we do that, then pretty much everything that I talked to you about today will apply in dedicated as well. And in fact, you know, we feel very strongly that the level of security and data isolation that we provide with Fort Knox is actually superior to the level of security and data isolation that we provide with dedicated SQL today. So we feel like for dedicated customers, this is actually a huge win. It gives you the elasticity that you want and the growth that you want, while giving you a tremendous amount of security. But it is a change, and so we're cognizant of that, and we want to have a dialogue about it.
But all the operational stuff you talked about earlier, that'll apply after?
Yes, that will apply. Today, most of the operational teams are integrated, but they're sort of integrated on two different stacks, and our deep desire is to get those stacks closer together. And I think one thing you've heard us talk a lot about OneDrive for Business. And I know one thing that dedicated customers have been very vocal about wanting is, well, we really want that. And so we think, maybe one of the first ways that we will show that integration is by saying, hey, why don't we start with OneDrive? Picking up and moving everything is a big project. It's going to take all of us some time to work out. We've got to figure out what we're going to do about CAM and et cetera. But you know, can we build a hybrid solution where we give you OneDrive for business in the multi-tenant fabric and offer you that capability earlier? So I'm glad to see you nodding, okay. Yeah. You next. Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I know that we're starting to use Bits for non-office documents, and so we will get the sort of incremental upload. I don't know whether there are plans for shredding other document types, but I can follow up on that. Question back there? What we see with, Fort Knox does not use the RBS provider that we have on-prem. It uses a more direct proprietary path. And so our data so far shows that we are not seeing any performance degradation from using that path. And in fact, we think we will start to see performance wins because we'll be able to serve the content directly from Azure, and we may be able to farm those out and get them closer to the customer rather than having to route directly through us. But we'll see. So we think that our data says that there is not a performance degradation. Yeah, there's definitely a chance. We haven't really sort of evaluated how we would bring it to on premise, but it makes a lot of sense. And we're also talking. Unfortunately, Zach's talk was at the same time as this one, but we're talking with the StorSimple team about how can we better leverage the StorSimple solution as well, which we think that's probably the right way to do. Cloud-backed, infinite scale storage for an on-prem SharePoint deployment. Yeah. Yeah, the way we do, so we're actually already using Azure Blob for our backups today. It's actually one of the key ways that we were able to improve our disaster recovery failover mechanics. So that your question is, if I'm taking backups, so the backups, all right. Documents that are stored in, there's sort of two kinds of backups you could talk about. There's backups of the SQL metadata itself. That stuff, we take the backups, we route that through, we route those backups through Azure Blob. The keys are sort of maintained intact across that. And then the content that is put in Azure Blob itself, that gets backed up by the Azure Blob storage team. We don't need to change the keys, or at least as far as I understand, there's no need to change the keys as the backups move around, because you'd want the key. It's as far as Azure is concerned, it's just a bunch of encrypted goop, and they're storing. Sorry. Yes, but the keys that we change. This is a good point. The keys that we change are the access keys into Azure. So there's an account that you use to get access to a particular Azure store, And in fact, we have three different accounts, one that does read, one that does write, and one that does delete. So you actually only use the account that does the particular operation that you want. It's those keys that we change every day. So it's the access keys into the vaults. The actual shred keys, the keys to the shreds, we don't change. I mean, in theory, you could, but you would have to reach out and touch all the blobs, which you don't want to do. So we can change that key, and in principle, we can change this key. So we can re-encrypt the keys in here. That's not too much overhead, but it's really the keys to get access to the vault. So, you know, if you had access to the vault yesterday, the keys that got you access to the vault yesterday don't help you today. Yes, that is true. The key store we have to maintain. That is a detail I don't have. That's a detail I don't have. But you're right, we do have to maintain that. I don't know if it's just that we keep a backup every day, and so we just have to roll back. Interesting. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. The metadata in the content database, we actually use BitLocker to do our encryption at rest. We found that rather than doing transparent data encryption at the database layer itself, we prefer to do encryption at the role, because that way we can do encryption across all of the roles. There's a bunch of roles that are not SQL roles that have caches of user data, and so you want to make sure that those caches themselves are encrypted as well. So we use BitLocker throughout. Okay? All right, we'll call it good. I got business cards up here if folks want to follow up and any.